You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 232 by Rudolf Steiner, 14 lectures, entitled Mystery Knowledge and Mystery Centers, translated by Pauline Wurla. This is Lecture 13, entitled The Transition from the Spirit of the Ancient Mysteries to the Medieval Mysteries. The mysteries of the various ages, as I said yesterday, were scattered in various forms over many regions of the earth, and every region, according to its population and other conditions, had its special form of the mysteries. But now there came a time which was of extraordinary significance for the mysteries. It was the period in the earth's evolution which began some centuries after the foundation of Christianity. From my book, titled Christianity as Mystical Fact, you can see that what happened on Golgotha united, in a certain sense, what had previously been distributed over the various mysteries throughout the world. The mystery of Golgotha, however, differed from all the other mysteries I have been describing, in that it was presented, so to say, on the stage of history, before the eyes of the world. While the older mysteries were enacted in the obscurity of the inner temples, and they sent out their impulses from the dim twilight of these inner temples. If we look into the Oriental mysteries, or into those I described to you as the mysteries of Ephesus in Asia Minor, or again if we look into the Greek mysteries, be they the Thonic or the Eleusinian, or those I spoke of yesterday, the Samothracian, or finally, if we look into those mysteries I characterized as the Hibernian, we see in every instance how the mystery in question was enacted in the obscurity of the inner temple, from where it sent out its impulses into the world. Whoever understands the mystery of Golgotha, and merely to know the historical information available is not to understand it, whoever really understands the mystery of Golgotha understands all the previous mysteries. The mysteries that preceded the mystery of Golgotha and culminated in it all possessed a particular characteristic in respect of the feelings they aroused. In the mysteries, many tragic things took place. Whoever attained to initiation was obliged to undergo suffering and pain. You know these things. I have described them to you many times. By and large, before the time of the mystery of Golgotha, if a candidate was to go through initiation and was warned beforehand that he would have to face many tests and trials, to suffer pain and sorrow, he would still have said, quote, I will go through all the fire in the world, for it leads to the light, to the spiritual fields of light, where I may attain to a vision of what in a particular era can be only dimly divined in ordinary human consciousness on earth. Close quote. A really great longing, a longing that was simultaneously joyful, took possession of anyone who sought to find his way to the ancient mysteries. His joy was certainly solemn and deep and lofty too, yet joy it certainly was. Then came an intermediary period. In the lectures that are to follow in a few days, I shall have to characterize things from the historical point of view. The intermediary period led ultimately to the 14th and 15th centuries, when, as you know, a new epoch of human evolution began. And now we find an altogether different mood in those who were setting out on the search for knowledge of the higher worlds. It is indeed a fact that when, with the help of the Akashic records, we look back into the ancient mysteries, we find joyful faces, deeply serious, but fundamentally joyful faces. If I were to describe to you a scene which can be read in the Akashic records, for example, a scene in the Samothracian mysteries, I should have to say that the countenances of those who entered the innermost temple of the Kabiroi were meaningful and profound, but nevertheless joyful. But now came the intermediary period, a time when there was not actually a temple, yet there was moral cohesion, as there had already been in the ancient mysteries. We come to what is described as the form of Rosicrucianism of the Middle Ages. If we want to characterize the Rosicrucian mystery pupil in the way I have just done for the unique mysteries, we shall have to say something very different. The most important of the personalities striving for knowledge in medieval times and who undertook research into the spiritual world bore not joyful, but very tragic faces. And this is so true that we can say, those who did not have a deeply tragic expression were certainly not sincere in their efforts. There was abundant reason to have a tragic expression on their faces. Let me now give you a picture of the way in which those who strove for knowledge in this period, culminating in the Rosicrucianism of the 14th and 15th centuries, gradually had to relate differently to the secrets of nature and of the spirit than did the pupils of the mysteries in ancient times. Yesterday I already drew your attention to the fact that, for the people of olden times, the phenomena and processes of nature were nothing less than deeds of the gods. They would as little have thought of treating a phenomenon of nature as an isolated phenomenon as we should think of considering a movement of the human eyes as a thing in itself, and not as a revelation of the human soul and spirit. Natural phenomena were considered to be expressions of the gods who manifested through them. For the ancients, the earth's surface was as truly the skin of the divine earth being as our skin is the skin of an ensouled human being. We really have not the least understanding of the mood of soul of the people of antiquity, unless we know that they were speaking of the earth as a body of the gods, and of the other planets of our planetary system as brothers and sisters of the earth. But now this direct relation to the things and processes of nature, which saw in the single object or phenomenon the revelation of the divine principle, changed into a totally different one. The divine part of natural phenomena had, so to speak, withdrawn. Supposing it could happen to one of you that people saw you merely as a body, as we do the earth, neutral and soulless, it would be absolutely horrible. But this horrible thing has really happened, where modern knowledge is concerned. And medieval scholars felt the horror of it. For from the standpoint of modern knowledge, it is as though the divine principle had withdrawn from natural phenomena. And whereas in ancient times the objects and processes of nature were revelations of the divine world, now came the intermediary period, when the phenomena of nature were only pictures, no longer revelations, but only pictures of divine manifestation. Ancient times, natural objects and processes, revelations of a divine world. Medieval times, natural objects and processes, pictures of a divine world. However, a modern person does not really have any idea in what way natural processes are pictures of a divine world. Let me give you an example that anyone can be familiar with who knows a smattering of chemistry. It will show you what sort of conception of science those people had, who at least still had the view that natural objects and processes are pictures of a divine world. Do a simple experiment which is continually being done by chemists today. Take a retort and put into it oxalic acid, which you can get from clover, and mix this oxalic acid with an equal part of glycerin. Then you heat the mixture, and carbon dioxide will be given off. When the carbon dioxide has evaporated, what remains behind is formic acid. The oxalic acid is transformed by the loss of carbon dioxide into formic acid. This experiment can easily be done in a laboratory, and you can look at it as a modern chemist does, namely as a complete and finished process. Not so a man of the Middle Ages before the 13th and 14th centuries. He looked at two different things. He said, oxalic acid is found especially in clover, but it occurs in a certain quantity in the whole human organism, in particular in the part of the organism comprising the digestive organs, spleen, liver, and so on. In the area of the digestive tract, you have to reckon with processes that are under the influence of oxalic acid. Now it happens to be the case that this oxalic acid, which plays a part in the human abdomen, is acted upon by the human organism itself in a way which is similar to the action of the glycerin in the retort. Here, too, we have a glycerin action. And note the remarkable result. Under the influence of the activity of glycerin, the transformed product of oxalic acid, namely formic acid, passes into the lungs and the breath. And we breathe out carbon dioxide. We send out our breath, and with it we send out carbon dioxide. You can imagine instead of the retort, the digestive tract. And where the formic acid is collected, you can imagine the lungs. And higher up, you have carbon dioxide in the air breathed out from the lungs. A human being, however, is not a retort. The retort just demonstrates in a dead way what takes place in a human being in a living and feeling way. And this is really how it is. If a human being never produced oxalic acid in his digestive tract, he would simply not be able to live. That is to say, his etheric body would have no sort of basis in his organism. If a human being did not change oxalic acid into formic acid, his astral body would have no basis in his organism. Human beings need oxalic acid for their etheric body and formic acid for their astral body, or rather, it is not the substances they need, but the inner activity going on in the oxalic acid process and the formic acid process. This is, of course, something which a present-day physiologist has yet to discover. He still speaks of what goes on in the human being as if these were external processes. This was the first question put by the student of natural science in medieval times, as he sat in front of his retort. He asked himself, quote, such is the external process which I observe. Now, what is the nature of the similar process in the human being? Close quote. The second question was this, quote, what is the same process like in the great world of nature outside? Close quote. In the case of the example I have chosen, the researcher of those days would have said as follows, quote, I look out over the earth and see the world of plants. Oxalic acid is present in a marked degree in wood sorrel and in all kinds of clover. But in reality, oxalic acid is contained in all vegetation, even if it is sometimes in homeopathic doses. There is a touch of it in everything. The ants find it even in decaying wood. The swarms of ants, which we human beings often find so troublesome, get hold of the oxalic acid, which occurs all over the fields and meadows, and is indeed found wherever there is vegetation, and change it into formic acid. We continually breathe in the formic acid out of the air, although in very small doses, and we are indebted to the work of the insects on the plants for changing the oxalic acid into formic acid. And the medieval student would say to himself, quote, this metamorphosis of oxalic acid into formic acid takes place within us human beings. And in the activity going on in nature, this same metamorphosis is present, close quote. These two aspects presented themselves to the student with every process he carried out in his laboratory. There was, besides, something else most characteristic of the medieval student, something that has today been completely lost. Today we think, why, anyone can do research in a laboratory. It does not matter in the least whether he is a good or bad person. All the formula are available. You only have to analyze or synthesize. Anyone can do it. However, in the days when nature was approached quite differently, when people saw in nature the working of divine forces, both in humanity as well as in the great world of nature, then it was required of them that a human being who did research should at the same time have an inner piety. He must be ready to turn, in soul and in spirit, to the divine spiritual principle in the world. And it was a recognized fact that if a person prepared himself for his experiments as though for a sacred rite, if he were inwardly warmed in soul by the pious exercises he went through beforehand, then he would find that the experiments led him, on the one hand, inward to an investigation of the human being, and on the other hand, outward to the examination of external nature. Inner purity and goodness were thus regarded as a preparation for research, and they regarded the answers they received to their questions posed by their laboratory experiments as being willingly given by divine spiritual beings. This gives you a characteristic picture of the transition from the spirit of the ancient mysteries to mysteries such as were able to exist in the Middle Ages. A certain amount of the content of the ancient mysteries still found a place in the medieval mysteries as a kind of tradition. Nevertheless, it was impossible in the Middle Ages to attain to the greatness and sublimity even of the mysteries that survived comparatively late, such as those of Samothrace or Hibernia. In a traditional way, what is called astrology has, of course, been preserved right up to our day, and the same applies to alchemy. But nothing is known today of the conditions necessary for real knowledge of astrology or alchemy. In fact, these conditions were hardly known anymore, even in the 12th and 13th centuries. It is quite impossible to arrive at astrology through thought or empirical research. If you had suggested such a thing to those who were initiated in the ancient mysteries, they would have replied, quote, "You can have just as little hope of being successful in discovering astrology through thought and empirical research as you can have of reaching a person's secrets by those means if he does not tell you them." Close quote. Suppose there were a secret known to one person and to no one else, and someone were to contend that he was going to find it out by making experiments or by pondering on it. It would, of course, be absurd. He can learn the secret only by being told it. And the ancients would have found it equally absurd to try to arrive at a knowledge of astrological matters by pondering on them or by doing experiments or observations. For they knew that it is the gods alone, or, as they were called later, the cosmic intelligences, who knew the secrets of the starry worlds. They knew them, and they alone could tell them to human beings. Therefore, human beings have to pursue the path of knowledge that leads them to a good understanding and relationship with the cosmic intelligences. A true and genuine astrology depends on a person's ability to understand the cosmic intelligences. And what of true alchemy? That does not come from doing research after the manner of a chemist of today, but upon being able to perceive the nature spirits within the processes of nature, and on being able to come to an understanding with them, so that they tell you how the processes take place and what really happens. In those ancient times, astrology was no spinning of theories or fancies. Neither was it mere research through observation. It was a conversation with the cosmic intelligences. And alchemy, too, was a conversation with nature spirits. This is the first thing you have to know. If you had approached an Egyptian of ancient times, or particularly a Chaldean, he would have told you, quote, "I have my observatory for the purpose of holding conversations with the cosmic intelligences. I hold conversations with them by means of my instruments, for my spirit is able to speak with the help of my instruments." Close quote. And the pious medieval natural scientist, who stood in front of his retort, investigating on the one hand the activity inside the human being and on the other hand the activity of nature as a whole, he would have told you, quote, "I do experiments because through experiments nature spirits speak to me." Close quote. The alchemist was the person who conjured up nature spirits. What was regarded later on as alchemy was no more than a decadent product. The whole of ancient astrology owed its origin to converse with the cosmic intelligences. By the time of the first centuries after the rise of Christianity, ancient astrology, that is to say, converse with cosmic intelligences, was a thing of the past. The tradition was still there. When the stars stood in opposition, or in conjunction, and so on, then calculations were made accordingly. They still had everything which existed in the way of tradition from the times when the astrologer conversed with cosmic intelligences. By this time, however, that is to say, a few centuries after the founding of Christianity, although astrology was already over, alchemy still remained. Converse with the nature spirits was still possible in these later times. And if we look into a Rosicrucian alchemical laboratory in the Middle Ages, let us say in the 14th or 15th century, we find instruments not unlike those of the present day. At any rate, one can gain some idea of them from the instruments in use today. But when we look with spiritual vision into those Rosicrucian mysteries, we find everywhere the earnest and deeply tragic personality of whom Faust is a later and indeed lesser development, particularly Goethe's Faust. For in comparison with the scholar in the Rosicrucian laboratory, with his deeply tragic countenance, who can really no longer cope with life, in comparison with him, Goethe's Faust is something like a newspaper print of the Apollo of Belvedere, as compared with the real Apollo, when he appeared at the altar of the Cabiroi, taking form in the clouds of sacrificial smoke. It was so indeed. When one looks into these alchemical laboratories of the 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries, one is confronted with a very deep tragedy. This tragic mood, which belonged to the most earnest people of the Middle Ages, is not properly recorded in history books, for the writers of those books have not looked into the depths of the human soul. But the genuine scholars who made investigations with retorts to learn about the real nature of the human being and the cosmos were, in the early Middle Ages, none other than glorified Faustian characters. They were all deeply conscious of one thing. They could all say, quote, "When we experiment, nature spirits speak to us, the spirits of the earth, the spirits of the water, the spirits of fire, and the spirits of the air. We hear their whispering murmuring, the coming and going of their voices growing into harmonies and melodies, and retreating again. Melodies resound when nature processes take place," close quote. These scholars stood over their retorts and, in piety of heart, steeped themselves in the process that was taking place. For example, in this very process of the transformation of oxalic acid into formic acid, when they asked a question, the nature spirit gave answer, so they could make use of the nature spirit for what was going on in the human being. First of all, the retort began to speak in color. They perceived the nature spirits of the earth and the nature spirits of the water rising up out of the oxalic acid and asserting themselves. But then the whole apparition changed into the humming sounds of melodies and harmonies growing and retreating back into itself again. Such was their experience of the process that results in formic acid and carbon dioxide. And if one was able to enter into the life of this transition from color into sound, then one could also enter with a deep and living knowledge into what the process could tell one about nature as a whole and about the human being. They arrived at the feeling the things and processes of nature reveal something more, something which is spoken by the gods, for they are pictures of divine being. And one can turn the knowledge to good account for human beings. Throughout these times, the knowledge of healing was closely and intimately bound up with the knowledge of their worldview in general. Now let us imagine we had the task of developing therapy based on such perceptions. We have a human being in front of us. The same complex of external symptoms can, of course, be an expression of a whole variety of illnesses and their causes. However, with a method that arises from this kind of knowledge, I do not say it can be done today as it was done in the Middle Ages, for today, of course, it has to be quite different. But with such a method, we would be able to say, if a certain complex of symptoms occurs, then it shows that the human being is unable to transform enough oxalic acid into formic acid. He has become too weak in some way to do it. We should possibly be able to provide a remedy by giving him formic acid in some form, to give him help from outside if he himself cannot produce formic acid. Now, it might happen in the case of two or three people whom you have diagnosed as not being able to produce formic acid, that you treat them with formic acid, and it works quite satisfactorily. Then you get a person with a similar complaint to whom you give formic acid, and it does not help at all. However, directly you give him oxalic acid, it helps immediately. Why is this? Because the deficiency of forces is somewhere else, namely, where the oxalic acid ought to be changed into formic acid. In such a case, if we were to think along the lines of a researcher of the Middle Ages, we should say, quote, yes, under certain circumstances, the human organism, on being given formic acid, will reply, I do not want it. I do not ask for it in the lung or anywhere like that. I do not need it brought into the breath and the circulation. I want to be treated in quite a different place, namely in the region of the oxalic acid, for I myself want to change the oxalic acid into formic acid. I do not want the formic acid. I want to make it myself. Close quote. This is how different the situation can be. Of course, a great deal of swindling and stupidity has gone on under the name of alchemy. But for the genuine scholar who was worthy of the name, the subject of his research was always the study of healthy human nature, in close connection with human nature when in a sick state. And this led to nothing less than converse with the nature spirits. The medieval scholar definitely sensed, quote, I am associating with nature spirits. There was a time when human beings associated with cosmic intelligences. That is barred to me. Close quote. In fact, my dear friends, since the nature spirits too have withdrawn from human ken, and the things and processes of nature have become the abstractions they now appear to be to the physicists and chemists of today, the tragic mood which was there in the Middle Ages no longer arises. For it was the nature spirits, who themselves could just reach back that far, who awakened in the medieval scholar the yearning for the cosmic intelligences. These had been accessible to the ancients, but the medieval scholars could no longer find the way to them with the means of knowledge at their disposal. They could only find their way to the nature spirits. The very fact that they did perceive the nature spirits and were able to draw them into the field of knowledge made it so tragic for them that they were not able to approach the cosmic intelligences by whom the nature spirits themselves were inspired. They perceived what the nature spirits knew, but they could not penetrate through them to the cosmic intelligences beyond. That was the mood of the time. The real cause of this tragedy was that while the medieval alchemists still acquired knowledge from the nature spirits, they had lost touch with the knowledge of the cosmic intelligences. And this in turn was also the cause of the fact that they were unable to attain to a complete knowledge of the human being, although they were still able to divine where such knowledge was to be found. And when Faust says, quote, and here, poor fool, with all my lore, I stand no wiser than before, close quote, we may really take the words as reminiscent of the feeling that prevailed in many a laboratory of the Middle Ages. For ultimately it was the nature spirits who gave the laboratory scholars what they knew, but they could not give them real knowledge of the soul. By today, a great deal has been lost, even in the way of tradition, but it must be found again, These medieval scholars had also heard of reincarnation. When they were in their laboratories, however, the nature spirits were in the habit of speaking about all kinds of things relating to substances or giving descriptions of occurrences in the world. But they never spoke at all about repeated earth lives. They took no interest in the subject at all. So, my dear friends, I have given you some of the thoughts which gave rise to the fundamentally tragic mood of the medieval natural scientist. He is indeed a remarkable figure, this Rosicrucian scientist of the early Middle Ages. Standing in his laboratory, with his deeply serious and sorrowful face, not skeptical of human understanding, but filled with a profound uncertainty of heart, with no weakness of will, but with the awareness, quote, "I have indeed the will, but how am I to guide it so that it may take the path that leads to the cosmic intelligences?" Close quote. Innumerable were the questions arising in the heart of the medieval natural scientist. The monologue at the beginning of Faust, with all that follows, is no more than a weak reflection of his endless questioning and striving. Tomorrow we will take a closer look at this earnest scholar, with his deeply moving countenance, who is really the ancestor of Goethe's Faust. The end of Lecture 13.